This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip around the world with As It Happens. From the complex headlines of the day to the weird and wacky, As It Happens brings you the story behind the story. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/as it happens.
Hello, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is the Vinyl Cafe. So here we are, perched on the edge of June, on the edge of the summer of 2013, crouched as if we were crouched on the edge of some northern lake, staring out at the black water, trying to remember, are we the kind of person who jumps in headfirst without checking the temperature, without bending down and scooping up a handful and throwing it over our backs? Are we the diving type who dive in all minky and sleek, pushing off with our feet from the edge of the dock, that moment of stretched anticipation, and then the smack and the waiting, one, two, three, until we appear on the surface, roll onto our back, shake our head, and then roll off 100 yards of crawl without stopping. Is that us? Or do we climb down the ladder, inch by excruciating inch, easing ourselves torturously into summer, not sure, really, if we want to be here at all? Are we the reckless diver or the ladder-hugging fraidy cat? We better figure it out soon. It is June. It's time to get out the bathing suit and the beach towels. Time, if you will allow me, to say a few words about swimming. The most reckless of the summer pastimes. Reckless? Are you kidding? If you're going in, you're going in over your head, baby. And there have been no advances, none whatsoever, for centuries. No helmets, no seat belts, no apps. It's just you, the devil, and the deep blue sea. Jump in, climb in, doesn't really matter. Because if you get in, you're on your own. So what's it going to be? Are you just going to paddle about? Or do you want to race me to the island? The first time I went snorkeling was in the cold, blue, wavy coral sea. I felt as if I'd climbed into the aquarium in my dentist's office, or into a Disney animation. No one had prepared me for the absolute beauty. Goggles and flippers and the perfectly weighted lead belt that allows you to hover 10 feet down, or however deep you need to hover to lose yourself in the silent world of neon. They say it's like flying. It is like flying, or what flying would be like if we could. Closer, say, than skydiving, which is like falling stone-like toward the ground. And stones don't fly. They fall. Swimmers fly, and there are neither brakes nor ripcords nor safety nets. Across the top of the pool, or 10 feet down, floating with the colored fish, or just jump into the lake, take a deep breath, and bring your knees to your chest. The jellyfish float. The backstroke. The side stroke. The cannonball. Teaching a child to swim is like watching a bird learn to fly. No, not like it. It's exactly the same. Because you can't teach it. Not the first bit. The first bit, like that first step off the edge of the nest, isn't an act of learning. It's an act of faith. It's a deep breath, push off, make yourself long and flat, and kick your feet. Kick! The breath and the long, thin body and the kicking feet, and look at you! You're swimming. Of course, there's also putting your face in the water, and not long after that, there's the running out of breath. But that's what the shallow end's for. So you can stop and catch your breath. But once you've done that, you're doomed. Because eventually, you'll want to go where we all spend most of our lives, over our heads. And the fact that we can do that is really a miracle. Because once you're in the deep end, there are no nets. If you are over your head, you are over your head, and that, my friend, is that. I used to swim laps in the classically arched pool at Hart House at the University of Toronto. Sometimes, when no one else was there, the lifeguard would indulge me and turn off all the lights except for the ones under the water. And the deep blueness of it made me feel as if I was back in the blue coral sea. Once after a vinyl cafe show on Salt Spring Island, we were taken down some back roads to some frigid wharf, and we all swam in the bioluminescence of the Strait of Georgia. It was well after midnight, and there we were, paddling around with the twinkling lights both above and below us, as if we were floating in some mysterious starry universe, as if we were stars ourselves. Which is to say, swimming can be magic as well as refreshing. And so it's summer. Time to seek the comfort of water, the magic of lakes, and to stay in just a little longer than we should, to climb out and towel dry, to lay in the sun, to sit on the porch, to watch the sunset, or maybe rise. Doesn't matter, really, if you rise early or late. What matters is you swim. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short, but after that, it's up to you. We'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of our latest Vinyl Cafe book. It's called Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. We have a story today from Janet Incher of Chelsea, Quebec. Dear Stuart, writes Janet, it's been almost 50 years now, but the humiliation of the day I'm writing you about is etched in my mind with such clarity that my ears still burn at the thought of it. I usually push the memory away when it comes and return to whatever it was that reminded me of it. A day like this, perhaps, a hot day in June with the cicadas buzzing. The windows in our grade 6 classroom had been pushed up high to catch any stray afternoon breeze. The boys had beads of sweat on their upper lips from their lunchtime baseball game. So did Margie Ross. Margie got to play with the boys because she was such a good baseball player, as good as any boy, and we respected her for that. She never wore a dress, of course, even in June. In June, the rest of us girls were grateful to trade in our navy blue tunics for something more light and frivolous. If I'd stuck to the uniform or worn jeans like Margie, none of this would have happened. It was Mrs. DeCambra who started the nightmare. She directed us to take out our health textbooks, as she had done every day after lunch since the beginning of June. Playground gossip was that she had neglected the health curriculum all year and found it easier to have us read aloud than to teach a lesson in the final days of the school year. It was June 6th. I know this because when I went home for lunch, my mother gave me my birthday present, wrapped in white tissue paper. Instead of the usual gift, something sensible like a dictionary or a hairbrush, it was, to my utter amazement, a crinoline, a pile of pink and white lace and net. Crinolines were the latest thing in Montreal that spring. They puffed up dresses with froth and scratchy lace and made their lucky owners look divinely feminine. But this wasn't just any crinoline. This crinoline had a unique engineering design. Instead of layers of material on metal hoops, it had a hollow plastic ring 2 inches wide all around the bottom. The ring could be blown up by means of a little nozzle. Fully inflated, the crinoline stood out farther than anyone's. And so my dress floated saucily around me, swinging almost independently as I walked back to school. With a certain degree of self-conscious pride, I entered the warm classroom, watching my blue and white checked cotton dress miraculously borne aloft. I sat in row 6, by the window, second from the front. I slid carefully into my seat, pressing the bouncing undergarment under my desk as it tried to bob away. Behind me, Margie slouched in her seat. Feeling fluffy and beguiling, I cheekily turned around to her when the teacher's husky voice commanded us to take out our health books, and, in a stage whisper, I said, "I hate health." Too late, I saw the teacher's dark eyes staring at me. I froze. I stopped breathing. "What did you say, Janet?" said Mrs. DeCambra in her penetrating baritone. I colored. I stammered. I flushed. Mrs. DeCambra's eyes narrowed, and then a small smile lifted the corners of her mouth. "Come up to the front of the class and tell us all what you said." Silence dropped on the room. I agonized my way out of the desk and stood beside her, shamefaced and miserable. She repeated her order. "Tell us what you said." Turned partly towards me now, she was fully engaged, fastened onto me like a leech. My classmates' mouths hung open in thrilled expectation, electrified by my discomfort. Only Margie, her T-shirt still dirty from sliding into third base, looked worried. She locked her sympathetic eyes on mine. "Go ahead, tell the class what you said," boomed the voice beside me. It was clear that the only way to escape this unbearable situation was to get it out, get it over with, and get back to the safety of my desk. Neither the green of the trees outside the window, the drone of the cicadas, nor the rows of desks with their breathless occupants offered any relief. Heat flooded my neck, my face, my ears. I blinked back the tears of embarrassment that threatened to upset my composure. There were 30 pairs of eyes fixed on me with delight. I finally spat it out, defiantly staring at my classmates as I did. I said, "I hate health." "Louder," boomed Mrs. DeCambra. And louder I repeated it from my place in purgatory. "I hate health." I let my arms drop heavily to my sides. A gesture of defeat and humiliation. There, it was done. But no, it wasn't done. It had only just begun. I hadn't taken into consideration the physics of the situation. The weight of my dropped arms on the resilience of the fully inflated crinoline. As soon as my hands hit my sides, the crinoline leapt upwards, carrying my dress with it, leaving me dangerously exposed. I watched in disbelief and horror as the mass of gingham lurched up of its own volition toward my face. In sudden action, I pressed desperately down on the billowing cloth with both hands, causing the ringed tubing to rise enthusiastically to the side this time, again bearing my dress aloft. My memory gets a bit hazy at this point. It couldn't have taken as long as it felt, me wrestling with a jumping crinoline, the class giggling, then yelping, and finally howling with hilarity, Mrs. DeCambra giggling silently, her face twisting with the effort to remain stern, the roaring in my ears, and my eventual release to my desk. The next day after lunch, when we were told to open our health texts, Mrs. DeCambra flicked her eyes lightly and confidently in my direction. The look we exchanged acknowledged what we both knew, that the class had received the end-of-year lesson, and that was the importance of meekness and obedience on the one side, and the knowledge of power and control and who wielded it on the other. When Mrs. DeCambra asked Christine Banfield, the most articulate amongst us, to read the section on diarrhea, a word only Christine could have read without stumbling, not one of us breathed a whisper. And so, my classmates and I got to the end of the grade 6 health curriculum. But more importantly, on that hot day in June, we learned the lesson of power and submission. That story came to us from Janet Incher of Chelsea, Quebec. I used to be in Janet's class at Elizabeth Ballantyne School in Montreal West. She was Janet McIntosh then. Sadly, I wasn't in Mrs. DeCambra's grade 6 class, so I missed the moment of the crinoline until today. We have a Dave and Morley story for you now. This is a story about Morley's 40th birthday party. The day Morley turned 40, a Tuesday afternoon that seems so long ago and far away now, the day Morley turned 40, her friend and neighbor, Mary Turlington, came over after lunch with a little box wrapped in gold foil. It was just a token, the sort of trinket that women give to each other to mark special occasions. Ceramic creamer in the shape of a cat. The creamer's handle fashioned from the cat's tail. The cream designed to purr out of the cat's mouth. It's the sort of thing you'd pass with a shake of your head at a garage sale. But if you happen to get one on your 40th birthday, the sort of thing you might grow fond of, the way you can go fond of certain Christmas decorations. Women understand these things. In fact, only women possess the grace to pull something like this off. A man is not likely to drop in on a friend unannounced on his friend's 40th birthday and give him a ceramic creamer in the shape of a cat. Not in 1,000 years. And if he did, if, say, Bert Turlington was seized by some inexplicable spasm and in some altered state bought Dave a ceramic creamer for his birthday and wrapped it and took it to his house after dinner, if Bert Turlington arrived at Dave's house and gave him a ceramic creamer in the shape of a cat, no matter how cool it was, because a cat creamer could possess a certain retro coolness. No matter how cool it was, the transition would leave a trail of awkwardness and confusion that would hover between Dave and Bert for, well, quite possibly for the rest of their lives. For months, they would avoid each other in case the subject of the creamer arose. But Mary isn't Bert, and Morley isn't Dave. So on Morley's 40th birthday, which was several years ago, Mary Turlington knocked on Morley's front door after lunch. When Morley opened the door, her eyes were watery and red. She was holding a wad of Kleenex. She looked as if she had been weeping, had in fact been weeping on and off all morning. Morley, said Mary right away, what is the matter? Now, that's another thing a man wouldn't do. If Bert had knocked on Dave's door to give him a ceramic creamer in the shape of a cat, well, first of all, it wouldn't have been in the shape of a cat. It would have been in the shape of a dog. But if he had knocked on the door and Dave had answered the door with tears in his eyes, Bert would not have asked what was wrong. Not if he was thinking clearly. If he was thinking clearly, Bert would have done one of two things. He would have remembered something he needed to check at home. I'll be back in a minute, he might say. Or if he wasn't overwhelmed with a need to escape, if Bert wanted to stick around, Bert wouldn't have risked an emotional encounter. He would have helped by handing his friend a plausible excuse. He wouldn't have asked, what's the matter? He would have said, you cutting onions? But because she's a woman, and therefore possessed of an emotional fearlessness, Mary looked at Morley's red and watery eyes, and she drove right to the heart of the matter. Mary said, Morley, what is the matter? Morley's shoulders began to shudder. She opened her mouth, but no words came out. She shook her head, turned, and walked into the kitchen. Mary followed her. And they sat at the kitchen table. Finally, Morley said, how could he live with me so long and not know I would hate it? You mean tonight, said Mary. I don't want a birthday party, said Morley. I hate birthday parties. She had, in fact, hated birthday parties since she was a little girl, hated them ever since she could remember. Morley hated birthdays so much she had burst into tears at her own fifth birthday party the moment everyone began to sing happy birthday. Morley didn't like being the center of attention. She hated everything about birthday parties. She hated greeting people at the door. And she hated games like pin the tail on the donkey. She hated bursting balloons. She even hated presents. The year she turned 7, Morley sat in front of her pile of unwrapped presents and started to weep. I don't want to open them, she said. She was certain she wouldn't like one of the presents. And she was sure everyone would know. She was afraid she would hurt someone's feelings, afraid she wouldn't be a good enough actor. And now, 33 years later, Morley felt much the same about the neighborhood party Dave had planned for her 40th birthday. She didn't want to be the center of attention on her 40th birthday. She was afraid she wouldn't be a good enough actor. She had hoped the day would just slip by. It is just so insensitive, said Morley to Mary Turlington. She was fiddling with a little cat creamer as she talked. What do you guys normally do, asked Mary. What have you done on his birthday? Well, I never threw a party, said Morley defensively. Never, ever. Last year, said Morley, I gave him ballet tickets. Oh, said Mary. Year before, said Morley, shutting her eyes, I gave him a shaker blanket box. Year before that, asked Mary, cooking classes. I enrolled him in a vegetarian Indian cooking class, said Morley. He must have liked that, said Mary. Actually, said Morley, I'm not sure. If truth be told, it wasn't only the notion of being the center of attention that was upsetting Morley. If truth be told, a part of her was charmed that her husband had planned to make a fuss over her 40th birthday. However, she was anxious about the kind of fuss her husband might organize. As far as Morley understood, Dave's notion of a party was something that involved a keg of beer, a couple of bags of chips, and a crowd of people drinking the beer on empty stomachs. I hired a caterer, said Dave. You what? Said Morley. I've hired a caterer, said Dave. You don't have to do a thing. The caterer will come in the afternoon and bring the food and set everything up, and they'll clean up before they start, and they'll clean up when they've finished. What could she say? He wasn't begging her, but almost. So the party was on, and that's why Mary found Morley crying on the day she turned 40. Caterers were supposed to arrive at 3. Morley had agreed that she'd go out for the afternoon, she'd get her hair done, she'd have a facial, she'd go shopping. They'd leave a key under the mat, and the caterer would let himself in. They'll do everything, said Dave. No cleaning, said Morley. No cleaning, said Dave. No cleaning, no cooking, no nothing. You go out, you come home, everything will be ready. I have to get ready to go, said Morley to Mary Turlington, and she stood up and she started to clear off the table. Let the caterer do that, said Mary. Morley looked around the kitchen. There was a laundry basket on the counter. There were dirty breakfast dishes in the sink. There were footprints on the floor. I was going to wash the floor, said Morley. No cleaning, said Mary. I can't leave a house like this, said Morley. Yes, you can, said Mary. That's the deal, right? And so off she went. And at 5:10, there she was, walking up the street toward her house. Except she wasn't walking up the street, she was swinging up the street. 40 years old, and Morley had just had her first facial, her first manicure. And she felt elegant. She felt sophisticated. Her hair felt light and bouncy, felt as if it was swinging back and forth like on a television commercial. She glanced down at her hands. Her nails were sparkling. Her face was glowing. She was moving with grace. She felt as if her posture had improved. She felt as if she was standing tall. She was utterly presentable. She held her nails up to her face, and she looked around the street, and she thought, please, Lord, let this be the moment I run into someone I haven't seen for years. And then she was thinking about what was waiting for her. She was thinking, in a moment she would walk into her house and there would be a caterer to greet her. She thought, how good it is to be rich. My servant is waiting. My servant who has been with me all these years, I should give him the weekend off. And that made her smile, and she thought, how could I cope without him? I don't even know where he keeps the coffee. And she laughed out loud, and she thought how wonderful it was to be so calm and elegant, how wonderful it was to have a faithful servant laying out plates of hot food on her dining room table while she sashayed along the street looking so good that birds were falling out of the very trees she was walking under. She could hardly wait to get home. She would breeze into the kitchen and check one of the dishes casually, as if this was something she was used to doing. And then she would go upstairs and stand in front of the mirror and check herself. She looked so darn good. It was 5:10 when she walked in the side door. She had expected to be wrapped in the steamy aroma of a kitchen going full blast. She had expected her dining room table to be groaning with hot plates and platters. She had expected hors d'oeuvres and entrees and salads and desserts. She had expected an abundance. She had expected an overabundance. She had expected excess. She stopped dead in her tracks. There was a laundry basket on the counter. There were dirty dishes on the sink. There were footprints on the kitchen floor. Not only was there no food, there was no sign of a caterer anywhere. There was a deficit of caterers. She phoned Dave at work. Dave wasn't at work. He left an hour ago, said Brian. He said to tell you he went to get a keg of beer. A keg of beer, choked Morley. And chips, said Brian. Morley's mouth fell open and she hung up. That was a joke, said Brian. But she didn't hear him. Brian phoned back. That was a joke, he said. Dave went to buy flowers. Is everything okay? The caterer isn't here, said Morley. Don't worry, said Brian. He'll show up. But people will be here in less than an hour, said Morley. Those guys work fast, said Brian. Don't worry. Okay, thought Morley. She went upstairs and stood in front of her full-length bedroom mirror. Her elegance had evaporated. She looked distressingly familiar. Her hair, which had been so flouncy on the street, had flounced into a tangled mess. She looked at the clock radio, 5:15. Guests would be arriving in less than an hour. She went downstairs to the kitchen. The laundry basket was still on the counter. The dishes were still in the sink. The footprints were still on the floor. Telephone rang. She looked at it with apprehension. Hello, she said. It was a man, an unfamiliar voice. Is that you, Mrs. Dave? Yes, said Morley. Who's this? I am Frank, your server, said the voice on the phone. Frank, said Morley, where are you? The voice said, I'm right here. Where are you? Morley said, I'm in the kitchen. There was an uncomfortable pause. The voice on the phone said, I don't see you. Morley said, well, where are you? The voice on the phone, Frank, said, I'm in the kitchen too. There was a longer pause. Then Frank said, I don't think you're in the kitchen. When are you coming home? Morley said, Frank, where are you exactly? Frank said, I'm by the stove. Morley couldn't help herself. She glanced across the kitchen toward the stove. She almost said, you are not. But she suppressed the impulse and she said instead, Frank, she said, what house are you at? I'm at your house, said Frank. 15 Chestnut. Frank said Morley, we don't live at 15 Chestnut. Morley could hear the gears grinding in Frank's brain. But, said Frank triumphantly, if you do not live here, why am I set up for your party at 15 Chestnut? Frank, said Morley, we live at 50 Chestnut. There was a longer pause. Frank, said Morley, why did the people at 15 Chestnut let you set up for a party they're not having? You're not home yet, said Frank. Frank, said Morley, how did you get in? There were men working on the deck, said Frank. They let me in. Frank, said Morley, I don't want to upset you, but I think you're at the wrong house. Morley had the portable phone in the crook of her shoulder. She had already picked the laundry basket off the kitchen counter, and she was running upstairs. She stopped on the landing. Frank, she said, don't cry. I just lit the sterno, he said. All the food's in the warming dishes. His voice had raised an octave. He said the house wasn't ready for a party. It took me an hour to tidy everything. And then he said, Mrs. Dave, what happens if you come home? Frank said, Morley, stay calm, I have a plan. This is not a good situation, said Frank. I'm not trained for this. Frank said, Morley, listen to me. I want you to turn the warming plates off. I want you to walk up the street. No, Frank, listen to me. I want you to run up the street. I want you to run up the street to my house. I want you to run to 50 Chestnut Street. There's a station wagon in the driveway. I'm going to put the key in the ignition. Bring everything down here. There was a sob on the other end of the line. Frank said, what about the Millers, Mrs. Dave? Who are the Millers, Frank, said Morley. There's a paper here on the counter by the fridge. It's addressed to Mr. Don Miller. If you don't live here, is it possible that Mr. Don Miller does? Morley took a deep breath. She said, the Millers aren't expecting you, Frank. I am. She felt like she was in the thick of a hostage taking. She felt like she was trying to talk a hostage taker out of his hideout. Mrs. Dave, said Frank, what happens if the Millers come home and find their house tidy and clean and smelling of chicken pot pie and vegetable cannelloni? Frank, said Morley, watching herself in the mirror, that is a risk we're just going to have to take. It took Frank 5 minutes to get down the street, and when he knocked on the front door, his face was white. Frank said, Morley, the key's in the car. Mrs. Dave, he said, Frank was wringing his hands. You don't understand, he said. You don't understand how much I cleaned up there. The house doesn't look like the same house anymore. Just go, said Morley. We won't say anything to anyone. Just go and get the food. Frank was nodding his head, but he was staring into the middle distance and he wasn't moving. Frank, said Morley. The tires squealed as he backed onto the street. Halfway up the block, he honked his horn and jammed on his brakes and swerved around a man on a bicycle. Dave. Dave watched in disbelief as his own car screamed to a halt halfway up the street. He watched as a man he had never seen before, a man in black pants and a white shirt, leapt out of his car and ran into Dr. Codwell's house. Dr. Codwell's old house. Dr. Codwell had sold his house just before Christmas. Before Dave could work out what to do, the man ran out of Dr. Codwell's house carrying a large silver dish. He threw it in the back of Dave's station wagon, and then he ran back in the house again. Dave couldn't believe his eyes. He was witnessing a robbery. And then as he stood there, trying to work out whether he should tackle a guy or call the police, a second car pulled into the driveway, and Don Miller stepped out. It took a while to sort things out. Mostly Don Miller couldn't believe what Frank had done to his house. It was full of contractors when Don had last seen it. Frank had rolled up the painter's drop cloths and swept up the sawdust and lugged a table up from the basement. Looks incredible, said Don Miller. I know, said Frank. And that is when Don Miller said, we haven't moved in yet. My wife and kids fly in tonight, but we're staying at a hotel until Monday. He said, we're staying there until the movers come. Why don't you leave everything here? Why don't you have your party here? And that's when Dave said, only if you bring your family. There's something liberating about a house without furniture. Dave set up a sound system in the empty living room, and they cranked it up, and eventually people danced. And when Don Miller arrived with his wife and their two kids, people phoned home and other kids drifted in. It was a grand party. Frank recovered his equilibrium and glided around the house with his bow tie askew, sleeves rolled up. People perched on countertops with plates in their laps. People sat all the way up the stairs sipping wine from glasses and beer out of the bottle. Someone sent out for pizza for the kids. At 11:30, while they were dancing in the living room with their shoes off, Morley leaned against Dave and said, I feel like a teenager. Which is exactly what Sam, 11 years old, said not 5 minutes later to Molly Miller, age 12. As he smoked his first cigarette with her in the Miller's garage. Smoked it? He would have eaten it if Molly Miller had asked him to. Miller's come from Indian Bluff, Saskatchewan, town of 2,000 people, where Don taught high school and Susan, his wife, worked in the bank. This is great, said Don Miller to Dave as they leaned against the kitchen counter just before midnight. We were scared of coming. Not tonight, not to this, to the city. Susan was offered an opportunity, and we had to try it, but we were scared we wouldn't meet anyone. We were scared Molly would fall in with the wrong kind of kids. By the time they bought out the cake, Morley had forgotten it was her birthday. Mary Turlington had got at the icing, and it now read, Happy Birthday, Morley, across the top, and Welcome Home, Millers, on the bottom. Don Miller gave a speech, and he was funny, and everyone applauded, and no one even noticed Morley when she sat down quietly in a corner and opened her presents. It was a perfect night, a night of spilled drinks and dancing and general youthfulness, a perfect night to turn 40. Sometime after midnight, Sam came to Morley and said he didn't feel good. I think I'll go home, he said. Too many Cokes, said Morley. I smoked, said Sam. Oh, said Morley. That always makes me feel sick, too. Me too, said Sam. Do you think I'll get cancer? Probably not, said Morley. Do you think you can quit? I think so, said Sam. I'm going to quit tomorrow. It was well past midnight, when Dave and Morley slipped quietly in the back door of their house. Dave poured himself a glass of water and leaned against the kitchen counter. Was that okay, he asked. Morley walked across the kitchen and put her arms around his neck and whispered in his ear, One more dance, she said. One more dance. And they danced slowly around the kitchen, dancing to music only they could hear. There was a laundry basket on the counter. There were dirty breakfast dishes in the sink. There were footprints on the floor. It was perfect. Thank you. That's the story we call Morley's Birthday Bash. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's show. David Amers, the founding producer of The Vinyl Cafe. Greg DeClute is the recording engineer. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton, and I'm Stuart McLean. So long for now.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.